everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I am your host, Tony, and today we're going to look at Castlevania, an action platforming title developed and published by Konami and released on the Nintendo Famicom Disk System in Japan in 1986, with cartridge ports following in 1987 for North America and 1988 for Europe. We're going to talk about that game in just a couple minutes, but first, as is usual, just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 81. I am excited to be here. I hope all of you are as well. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com. And we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. We have weekly gaming challenges. We have awesome discussions. I highly encourage everyone to check it out. I also highly encourage everyone to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/classicgamingtoday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including an exclusive Patreon podcast that comes out every 2 weeks, expansion pack, Patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday is where it's at. I'd also like to give a shout out to our Pantheon patrons. They are ISO, Rich Senewald, David Morton, Sam Twardowski, Sean Marshall, and Steve Novoselic. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you all for supporting the show, whether you contribute monetarily or simply listen on a regular basis. I truly do appreciate all of the support. For anyone who may be new, welcome. I'd like to take just a brief moment to go over the anatomy of an episode because, for the most part, all of our episodes follow a very similar format and structure. We will always start by talking about the history of the game in question, the historical context, how was the game made, why was the game made, and then we move into a pseudo-review kind of section. And I say pseudo-review because it's not like we assign numerical rankings or star counts or anything like that, but we do talk about every single game from several different perspectives. We take a look at the graphics. How does the game look? The sound and music. How does the game sound? The narrative and or story, if the game has one. Playability and controls and overall feel. What does it feel like to play the game today versus when it was released 20, 30, maybe even 40 plus years ago? We do all of that to reach a verdict as far as how well the game holds up today. And to do that, we assign each game to one of several categories. At the very top of our list is the Pantheon of Classic Gaming. If a game reaches the Pantheon, you know it is that darn good. It is a certifiable classic. You should go out of your way to play those games today. Just beyond the Pantheon are our golden oldies. These are still really good games. I still highly recommend you play them, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game exists. You should have an amazing time. They're not quite Pantheon level, but they're still really worthwhile experiences, and I still highly encourage you to play them today. Beyond the golden oldies, we reach our mediocre mentions. This is where we start getting into the realm of games that I cannot recommend to the broad population. They might have aged a little bit, might have had a couple of issues to begin with. You may still have a good time, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game lives. By all means, give it a go, but I cannot recommend these titles to the broad population. And then beyond the mediocre mentions, we reach the footnotes. These are the games that are best left in the annals of history. I have played them, so you don't have to. I cannot recommend anyone play these titles today. They have either aged incredibly poorly, or they may not have been all that great to begin with. With that out of the way, we're going to start talking about the game of the day. That is Castlevania. Castlevania is an action platforming title developed and published by Konami back in 1986 in Japan, with ports to North America and Europe following in 1987 and 1988, respectively. Before we can talk about Castlevania, we need to go back and talk about some of the folklore that the game is based upon, which means we've got to talk about the legend of Count Dracula. I'm going to venture a guess and say that most everyone has heard of and knows about some aspects of the origins of the Dracula character. Originally written about in literary form by Bram Stoker in 1897, his eponymous novel Dracula tells the story of a vampire who, in an effort to maintain his youth, lures innocent victims to his castle with the intent of draining and drinking their blood. As one of the most influential gothic horror literary works ever written, Bram Stoker's Dracula is the pop culture standard whenever someone thinks about the term vampire, and his work has been adapted into countless other forms and media over the years, with both spin-offs and modern interpretations serving to keep the mythology around vampirism alive and well even today. Now, some of you might be wondering, what was the inspiration behind Bram Stoker's novel? Here, though, the story isn't quite so clear. For many, Dracula's inspiration has always been thought to be Vlad III, a prince of Wallachia who is likely more well-known by the title granted to him by his enemies, Vlad the Impaler. Accounts of Vlad the Impaler's cruelty are widespread, with countless reports of him killing thousands of people, impaling them on stakes as both a warning to his enemies, as well as what was effectively a home decoration, as popular myth has depicted Vlad the Impaler sitting at his dinner table, with impaled bodies surrounding him as he collects his victims' blood in goblets. While there is absolutely no proof of that myth, and in fact, the concept of vampirism and bloodletting has never truly been mentioned in relation to Vlad III, oftentimes perception becomes reality, and in the minds of many people, Vlad the Impaler is effectively Dracula in real form, despite the claims by many scholars that most of the reports referencing his cruelty and prisoner torture were outlandish embellishments by the towns and villages that he conquered during his reign. Not the impaling part, mind you, because it is well known that Vlad had a thing for using impalement as his primary means of execution, but the other stuff, there's really no concrete proof for. Now, if you dig a little bit deeper, however, you'll see that there are several other potential inspirations behind the titular character, one of which is the Hungarian Countess Elizabeth Bathory, a serial killer who was accused of murdering hundreds of young women and girls over a two-decade period of time. Similar to Vlad III, however, it's not entirely sure how much of Bathory's backstory is true versus how much is popular myth. According to reports written at the time, one of the things Bathory was known for was bathing in the blood of virgins, the thought being that she could maintain her youth by using this not-so-common bath time routine. While this certainly sounds vampiric, there's absolutely no proof that this is true either, and while I can't claim any specific academic knowledge of either Vlad III or Elizabeth Bathory, the research I have done suggests that the truth is likely a bit less sensational than how popular culture has portrayed these figures. Going beyond named individuals, the concept of vampirism as a myth has existed for thousands of years, with pretty much every culture that has ever existed having their own form of vampires somewhere in their cultural record. Whether demons sent from some other plane of existence, or individuals who have returned from the dead due to their souls not being at peace, or even evil witches carrying out dark rituals, the conceptual vampire has, for all intents and purposes, always existed in some form or capacity, though the more modern interpretation of the vampire comes primarily from European folklore from the 18th century, which is when a number of previously verbal tales and parables that had been passed down from generation to generation began to be written down for future individuals to read and consume. So, when Bram Stoker sat down to begin writing Dracula, he had a wealth of potential inspirations available to him. And while researching content for his book, he wrote nearly 100 pages of notes to help form the lore and backstory for the novel he would eventually write. With those notes in mind, we can say conclusively that Bram Stoker's Dracula was 100% based on... who the heck knows? Seriously, there is so much debate about who and what the character of Dracula was based on that there is literally no consensus opinion at this point in time. Despite similarities in some respects to Vlad III and Elizabeth Bathory, none of Stoker's notes referenced either historical figure, though the general concepts of vampirism were frequently referenced throughout his working document. Which is to say, Stoker certainly took inspiration from a number of places, It's just unclear exactly what those places were. While Stoker's inspiration will likely never be truly known, it is very clear just how much Dracula inspired popular culture following its release in 1897, as it wouldn't take long before other authors and eventually filmmakers would begin taking the story of Count Dracula and adapting it for their own use. At this point in the story, though, we're going to take a bit of a leap forward to discuss one company that would become heavily inspired by Dracula, as well as other similar horror works by authors like Mary Shelley, and that would be film studio Universal Pictures. Universal Pictures was founded in 1912 and is today one of the oldest surviving film studios in the world, having built its company with over 100 years of cinematic releases across countless styles and genres. Back in the 1910s and 1920s, though, the world of film was dramatically different than what we've become accustomed to today, as prior to 1927, the concept of speaking in a film wasn't even a possibility, with silent films being the only style of cinema available to theatergoers. After 1927, though, which saw the release of the so-called talkie film, The Jazz Singer, film studios had an opportunity to improve and evolve their storytelling, bringing actors' voices into the filmmaking process for the first time ever. In many ways, this was similar to the popularization of CD-ROM technology for computers in the late 80s and early 90s, where previously text-driven games would be converted into talkie versions using voice actors to act out lines, rather than simply display text on a screen for players to read. Anyway, mild digression aside, Universal Pictures would quickly adapt to talkie productions, and over the next few years after the release of The Jazz Singer, several movies would be released by Universal that would take advantage of this new technology, culminating with the release of All Quiet on the Western Front in 1930, which ended up winning the Academy Award for Best Picture that year. After that release, Universal Pictures started to brainstorm how to increase their market share, and here they noticed untapped potential. In the silent film era, a number of different film genres had gained a fair degree of popularity, with one of them being what was commonly referred to as melodramatic romance with a dark element, which admittedly is a bit of a mouthful. The films that fell under this genre were those movies that were intended to elicit fear or dread in moviegoers, and filmmakers of the time leveraged past literary works to help inspire the creation of these movies. This is where we see one of the first film-based adaptations of the Dracula/vampire mythology, with 1922's Nosferatu, and over the decade, a number of other darker-themed films would be released as silent features. With the advent of talking picture technology, the opportunity was ripe for taking these darker-themed movies and reimagining them with full voice-acted dialogue, which is what prompted the creation of the Universal Monsters line of films, with the very first release in that newly created lineup being, you may have guessed it, Dracula. The Universal Monsters film line ended up being incredibly popular, and throughout the 1930s and 1940s, a number of films in what was now known as the horror genre were released to cinemas around the world. Beyond Dracula, Universal Monsters included films focused on mummies, Frankenstein's monster, the Invisible Man, and werewolves, just to name a few. And moviegoers ate them up, as they began going to theaters not simply to be entertained, but also to be frightened beyond belief. As some of the first films to be known as horror movies, these creature features would end up being influential on a number of future individuals across a wide variety of different creative mediums. And one of those people who had always held the Universal Monsters film line in high regard was Japanese game designer Hitoshi Akamatsu. Akamatsu had been a longtime fan of Western cinema, meaning the films coming out of Hollywood, and shortly after joining Konami, he would have the opportunity to put his love of film and related cinematography techniques to good use, as he began the development of the horror platformer that would eventually be known as Castlevania. Before we get to that, though, we need to talk a little bit about video game credits in the 80s, and even a bit into the 90s. Now, I know you might be thinking, video game credits? What the heck does that have to do with our discussion? Well, the reason I want to talk about video game credits is because, for years and years, nobody knew who was ultimately responsible for bringing Castlevania to life. And the reason for that is that many video game companies in the 80s refused to put real names in their games and credits. I know I often wondered why, after I would beat an 8-bit Nintendo game, I'd be met with a series of names that, from my perspective, seemed to be totally made up. Names like Piston Hondo, who was the name of a boxer from Punch-Out, would appear in the credits scroll of different games, and I just couldn't understand why. I assumed there wasn't a real Piston Hondo out there, but the fact that nearly every Japanese developer credit featured what appeared to be a pseudonym was a constant source of curiosity for me. Even from an early age, I wanted to learn more about the history behind my favorite video games, but these fake names didn't give me much to research. The reason for these fake names, as I would later find out, is that game studios, particularly those based in Japan, were highly concerned about other companies poaching their talent. So, rather than listing out real names in their credit screens, they would require each teammate to come up with a pseudonym, allowing the people who worked on their titles to remain somewhat anonymous, and therefore making it difficult for other companies to hire away their best and brightest employees. This sensitivity is what led to The Legend of Zelda being created by a man named Miyahon, with music composed by Konchan, as opposed to broadcasting that Shigeru Miyamoto was the game's director and Koji Kondo was the game's composer. Eventually, of course, that practice would fall out of favor, as game designers, developers, and other related talent would be properly credited in future titles. But for a period of time in the 80s and early 90s, Japanese game development studios made it especially difficult to track down who, in actuality, was working on their games. I mention this to say that Castlevania, for years, was only known to have been created by a person named Trans Fischers, which, as you might have guessed, is not a real person. Luckily, more info would come to light over the years, which is why today we know that Castlevania was actually designed by Hitoshi Akamatsu. So, to rejoin our original story, Akamatsu had always been fond of Western cinema, especially the Universal Monsters films of the 1930s and 1940s, and when he was given a chance to create a game for Nintendo's Famicom Disk System in 1986, he knew that he wanted to try to recreate those films' experience for gamers, albeit in interactive form. Now, an interesting trivia nugget about Akamatsu. Outside of his work on Castlevania, his love of cinema was fairly pervasive across Konami, because he took every opportunity he had to talk to other developers about the latest movies he had just seen, or his favorite movies that he had previously watched. The reason why Contra features an alien that resembles the xenomorph from the film Aliens is because Akamatsu wouldn't stop gushing over the alien's design when speaking with the rest of Konami's staff. He may not be as well known today, but he was surprisingly influential in Konami's mid-80s video game history. Anyway, as Akamatsu pulled together a team to begin creating Castlevania, he gave everyone a set of directives, with the most important one being that they needed their game to feel cinematic. Every aspect of the game's design was overseen by Akamatsu, and he would often work with artists and programmers directly to make sure that each scene in the game was framed similarly to how cinematographers and Hollywood directors would plan out their own video shoots. This led to Castlevania inheriting, so to speak, a number of environments that could have been taken right out of the Universal Monsters films from the 1930s, and also included a number of those characters and creatures as enemies in the game, most notably Dracula, obviously, and Frankenstein's monster. With the goal of making players feel like they were in a classic horror film, attention turned to the game's control scheme, and here, Akamatsu also had some pretty strong opinions. He believed that controls in video games should be simple, so much so that over time, the game's controller would act as a sort of extension of the player's body, making any game movements or actions feel like second nature to the individual controlling the game. To that end, he took extra care in ensuring that the control scheme would make sense to the player, and even ensured the sequence in which players are introduced to various sub-weapons was designed to best enable players to learn the foundational elements of gameplay before introducing them to more complex weapon subtypes. This meant that for many players, the first sub-weapon they'd encounter would be the straightforward knife, which effectively just fires in a singular straight direction. Future sub-weapons, like the stopwatch, axe, and boomerang cross, would be introduced as players continued through the game, oftentimes being aligned with certain encounters as a way to teach players how to use those weapons most effectively. The best example of this, and one that I'll talk about extensively during our review section of the discussion, is the fight with Grim Reaper, and the use of sub-weapons in that fight. For those who may be unaware, The fight against the Grim Reaper is widely considered to be one of the most difficult fights in the game, with an enemy that floats around the screen as he spawns projectiles that constantly fly towards you. The first time you encounter that fight, you will likely die quickly, and for good reason. Akamatsu designed that fight to do just that. He never intended players to beat that fight the first time they reached it. Instead, he designed the fight as an almost explicit skill check to see if players would realize that they needed to use one of two weapons, either the cross boomerang or the flying axe, to make the fight easier. In an interview, Akamatsu made his intentions clearly known, though he did also say that if someone were to beat the Grim Reaper with just the whip, it proves that they must be really good at the game. This level of design forethought and detailed consideration permeated the entire creation of the game, and there wasn't a single piece of the title that didn't have a significant amount of thought behind it. Take, for example, Dracula's head flying off the screen when you beat his first form. I'm sure many people figured, oh, that's just a cool effect, and a way to show that the fight is progressing. Well, in reality, Akamatsu intended that to act as a hint that Dracula himself would be resurrected in the future, effectively indicating that Dracula wasn't truly defeated. Or let's talk about the final boss of the game, which I always assumed was simply Dracula's second form. Not so, says Akamatsu. That second fight is meant to represent the curse of man and isn't actually a form of Dracula at all. It's meant to show that Dracula has been cursed, as will your character be should you actually defeat the final monster. Or let's talk about the clockwork gears in Dracula's castle. According to Akamatsu, those gears will always turn as long as Dracula is alive, and the reason that the clock tower collapses in the game's ending, as opposed to the entire castle, is because Dracula's corporeal form has been defeated, but his essence remains, just waiting to be resurrected. I admit, I am pretty impressed with how deeply Akamatsu considered the meaning behind each element of the game, and the lore-based reasons for his decisions are fascinating to learn about. With all of that lore in place, I was curious as to some of the other backstory elements to the game, specifically about the vampire hunter Belmont clan and their use of the various weaponry in the game, especially their fairly iconic whip. Here, though, Akamatsu had a bit more of a simple explanation. He explains that the reason he chose a whip as a primary weapon for Castlevania's protagonist is because it made sense for the gothic environment the game was based on, and was also a weapon that was considered good to repel enemy attacks. And, of course, because he was a huge fan of the Indiana Jones film, Raiders of the Lost Ark. The joy with which Akamatsu appeared to create the game was infectious, and that innovative spirit spread to the rest of the team, including the musical composer duo of Kunio Yamashita and Satoe Tarashima, both of whom would contribute various themes to the game. Interestingly, both composers faced some initial difficulty with creating music for video games, as both were recent Konami hires and had previously learned traditional music composition from college-level coursework. Going from an environment that allowed for nearly unlimited combinations of musical instruments to an 8-bit console that allowed for 5 sounds max to be played at once, one of which was solely white noise, would be an adjustment for anyone. But to their credit, Yamashita and Terashima both overcame those challenges and would put together a video game score that remains influential to this day. Eventually, Akamatsu's design and the rest of the game's features would come together, and Castlevania, or more specifically, Akumajo Dracula, would release on the Famicom Disk System in Japan in 1986, with a port to the Nintendo Entertainment System following in 1987. The name change to Castlevania was actually driven by the more conservative American video game companies and their stance on limiting any references to religion, sex, or other youth-corrupting elements in their titles. According to one Konami of America executive, Akumajo Dracula translates roughly as Dracula Satanic Castle, a reference that would simply not be releasable on an American Nintendo system. So, rather than keep the title and turn all of America's youth into evil worshippers of the Dark Lord, they decided a rename was in order, and here they looked at the game's setting and traditional vampiric lore. Where did the game primarily take place? In a castle. Where is Dracula most oftentimes noted to have come from? Transylvania. Put the two together, and you get Castlevania. Honestly, pretty ingenious naming scheme, and despite the censorship at play, I don't have any complaints about the end result. Regardless, though, of what you call it, Castlevania would prove to be a critical and commercial success, receiving a great deal of critical acclaim both during its release window as well as in the years following its release, with many praising the game's setting, gameplay, and environmental design elements, which felt ripped straight out of classic horror films. Players similarly would be impressed with the title, and it wouldn't take long before Castlevania would make its way onto a number of best games of all time lists, both among gamers around the world, as well as various magazines and other video game publications. And with that success, an entire media property would be birthed, as Castlevania would go on to have numerous sequels, spin-offs, crossovers, and, most recently, an incredibly successful adult animated series on Netflix that continues to receive critical acclaim. Castlevania titles have graced nearly every home console and many computer platforms over the last 30 years, and by 2006, the franchise had sold nearly 20 million copies across its various iterations and releases. While future titles would iterate on the original's design, the first Castlevania would also be re-released in a number of different compilations and collections over the years, most recently as part of the Castlevania Anniversary Collection in 2019, which is available on pretty much every modern gaming platform, as well as being one of the included titles on the NES Classic Mini console that was released in 2016. To say that it's a title that continues to be influential today would be an understatement. Not quite as influential, at least at the time of its release, was the version of the title that was released on the MSX2 computer platform alongside the Famicom release of Akumajo Dracula. This MSX2 version of the game, which was entitled Vampire Killer as opposed to Castlevania, would be developed and released in parallel with the original version of the title, though would be a decidedly different experience. Castlevania presents a mostly linear experience through the game's 18 stages, with each level effectively being a simple march from one side of a stage to the other, with a smoothly scrolling background making each stage feel interconnected and cohesive. The MSX2, somewhat famously, did not support smooth horizontal scrolling, as was the case with many computer platforms in the 80s, so Vampire Killer would be designed as a single-screen experience, where moving to the edge of a given screen would automatically load the next screen, similar to how you progress through The Legend of Zelda's world, albeit without the pan-over effect that the game used. So, every single enemy encounter was confined to a single screen at a time, with no ability to have enemies chase you from one screen to the next. More interesting than the lack of smooth scrolling, though, were some design decisions that fundamentally changed how the game was played. While the core premise and structure of the title remained the same as the original, with 18 levels and a boss following each grouping of 3 levels, and the music would be pretty much identical, the actual gameplay loop was a much more exploratory experience. Rather than simply moving from one side of a level to another, in Vampire Killer, you would be forced to find keys in order to open treasure chests in each level, and in order to progress from one stage to the next, you'd have to find a skeleton key hidden somewhere in the stage. This ended up creating a non-linear gaming experience that was, to a degree, a harbinger of the eventual Metroidvania genre that would become popularized by other Castlevania titles like Symphony of the Night, but this original incarnation would be met with much less critical acclaim. Many players thought that the non-linearity of the game hurt the experience, and searching entire levels multiple times just to find a hidden skeleton key that might require breaking an otherwise ordinary wall was not something that many gamers embraced. Instead, they voiced frustration with the gameplay and indicated that it was a vastly inferior game to the true original Castlevania title. While I haven't played Vampire Killer myself, I can appreciate the desire to try something new, and I believe that this experiment in different gameplay styles was Konami's way of testing the waters before continuing to refine the Castlevania formula for future installments of the series. As you might be aware, Castlevania II would diverge fairly dramatically from the original's tight design, with each title thereafter continuing to evolve the gameplay and mechanics beyond the original's fairly simple structure. This spirit of innovation has continued throughout the entire Castlevania franchise. And while I'd argue that not every single experiment truly hit the mark, when Konami struck gold, they really struck gold, as several Castlevania games, including the aforementioned Symphony of the Night, would go on to be considered by many to be some of the best games of all time, regardless of genre or platform. While Symphony of the Night will undoubtedly be a topic of discussion for a future podcast episode, even as far back as the original release, Castlevania was an impressive title. With Castlevania, Hitoshi Akamatsu, and by extension Konami, was able to take centuries-old myths, decades-old classic horror pictures, and modern, for the time, game design elements, and combine them to create something truly groundbreaking. As the first title in what would become one of the most popular franchises in gaming history, Castlevania set a high bar right out of the gate, and while subsequent releases would continue to improve upon the original, there is something to be said for the simplicity and purity of the very first Castlevania's design. Despite future titles somewhat eclipsing that title, Castlevania remains a must-play on many gamers' best games of all time lists, and as such, is definitely a title that deserves to be celebrated and remembered. Going to shift to start talking about what it feels like to play Castlevania today versus when it was released almost 40 years ago. Castlevania, at its core, is a platforming title with action elements included, almost similar to a side-scrolling shooter like Contra, but with decidedly less shooting. As you play the game, you'll progress through a series of levels, making your way from one side of the screen to the other alongside a horizontally scrolling stage. Moving through each stage follows fairly traditional platforming mechanics, where you can walk and jump to both move and traverse obstacles respectively. Making your way through a level typically involves jumping from one piece of ground to another, or jumping down from a higher perch, or potentially jumping onto some moving platforms. And while the platforming piece of the game is a core element of gameplay, I would argue that the platforming here is considerably lighter than what you might see in games like Super Mario Bros., where each level's design is effectively a puzzle to solve. Castlevania also presents levels as puzzles to solve, but for this game, the puzzle is how to get past the various enemies that inhabit the stage, not necessarily how to make a tricky jump or reach a seemingly unreachable platform, though to be fair, there's some of that here too. There are a ton of different enemies you'll encounter throughout your playthrough, some of whom move slowly and are easily dispatched, while others, like the floating Medusa heads, are the result of some evil pact with the Dark Lord made to torture any human who attempts to play the game. The enemy diversity here for an NES title is something to be commended, and despite my gentle rib at the Medusa heads, who are effectively demon spawns sent from hell to make you question your sanity, I enjoyed trying to figure out how to defeat or avoid each and every enemy in the game. Yes, even the Medusa heads, who are basically minions sent from Satan himself to capture defeated souls for his collection. On a more serious note, the way each level is designed, and the way each enemy type is used in combination with each other, is what makes up the core of the gameplay experience, and if you simply play the game for a brief period of time, you might walk away feeling like the developers simply threw a bunch of tough spawns at you and called it a day. That, however, could not be farther from the truth, as the enemy encounter design is actually the reason this game is as good as it is. I mentioned earlier that making your way through each level is effectively a puzzle, in that you need to figure out how to get past each enemy encounter in various stages. Well, this is pretty much exactly the way you need to tackle each stage, at least if you want to have any chance of success. The way it works, especially in the later stages, is that you'll often reach a stage and hit what can best be described as a roadblock, where you find a combination of enemies that seems like it can't possibly be beaten without losing some hit points. And oh, I should mention that in Castlevania, you do have a life bar similar to Ninja Gaiden, in that you can take several hits before you actually die. But There's not a whole ton of life-replenishing elements in the game. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. Anyway, getting back to our enemy encounters. You'll hit a point where you see a grouping of enemies that you feel can't be beaten without taking damage. You may be able to get past the enemies and proceed in the level, but it's not without trading some blows and losing some life. That, as you'll find out, is an issue, because the way the game is designed is as a series of three stages at a time, each of which ends in a boss fight of some form. If you make your way through those three stages, you'll reach what is effectively a checkpoint, as you can continue from that point even if you end up losing all of your lives. And Castlevania is surprisingly forgiving for an NES title, as you do have unlimited continues to play as long as it takes you to beat the game, or as long as your patience remains. But reaching those checkpoints and defeating those bosses require a good chunk of health and skill to actually pull off. Which means that every chance you get, you need to be conserving your hit points. While there are some health-restoring items available in the game, like I mentioned, they're often hidden in unassuming walls that you have to strike with your whip to reveal, and overall health replenishment as a result is not a guarantee. Which is why you need to really take the time to figure out the best way to defeat the groups of enemies you'll encounter, all while taking minimal damage. Hence my comment on the game's enemy encounter design being almost puzzle-like. So let me present you with a late game example, which is the march towards one of the final bosses in the game, the Grim Reaper. The path to the Grim Reaper is made up of two relatively simple stages with moderately challenging enemies, and one stage with an agonizing assortment of constantly spawning Medusa heads and incredibly tanky knights who throw boomerang-like projectiles at you. When you combine those two enemy types together, you have a recipe for disaster, as trying to progress forward towards your eventual goal, the Grim Reaper, is met with an unending assault of projectiles that, at first glance, appears impossible. After careful observation, though, you'll realize that a combination of jumping over some Medusa heads, ducking and whipping the knight enemies, moving back and forth along the arc of other Medusa heads' flight paths, and pushing forward aggressively gives you the best chance at success. You may still make some mistakes along the way, but as your muscle memory develops, you eventually see openings that you couldn't perceive before, and you come to realize that the entire stage is the NES equivalent of acrobatically slinking your way through a laser field in pursuit of some treasure in the center of a room, like those depicted in various heist movies. It is this eventual mastery that gives Castlevania its best moments, and the game is filled with such encounters throughout the entire experience. That being said, the game does a pretty good job of ramping up the difficulty as you play, so while each stage does have a puzzle, so to speak, to solve, not everyone requires the level of dexterity as the Grim Reapers approach. But the more you play the game, the more you'll notice this genius level encounter design, and you'll begin to appreciate the game on a whole new level. Equally impressive is the boss encounter design, where at the end of every set of three stages, you come face to face with one of the big bad guys of the castle. Similar to how you work your way through various stages, there are some boss fights in the game that will feel nearly impossible the first time you encounter them, like the aforementioned Grim Reaper fight, or the fight against Dracula himself. While I won't spoil any specific solutions here, I will say that every single boss fight is also a puzzle to be solved, and while some of the earlier encounters can be brute forced to success, the later fights require an actual strategy in order to be successful. From my perspective, the hardest fight in the game, and the one that I retrospectively respect the most, is the Grim Reaper fight. Reaching the Grim Reaper, like I mentioned earlier, requires progressing through several stages, one of which is pretty darn challenging to get through without taking damage. Assuming you do get past that stage, though, you're met with a fight that, the first time you reach it, I can guarantee you will believe is unfair. The Grim Reaper spawns, and immediately spawns several projectiles that will hone in on your location. Those projectiles can be killed, but basically as soon as one dies, another will be spawned to take its place. At the same time, the Grim Reaper himself will float back and forth across the battlefield, making it difficult to focus any damage on him, as most of your attention is being spent avoiding and defeating his spawned projectiles. If you're like me, your first reaction to the insanely quick death you likely just experienced is a resounding, "What the heck was that?" I have no doubt that there are several different strategies that you can use to tackle that fight, but the game actually gives you a subtle hint as to how it recommends you tackle that encounter, in that one of the preceding stages provides you with a secondary weapon that, from my perspective, is the solution to the puzzle of the Grim Reaper fight. For many of my first tries at the Grim Reaper, I completely neglected and avoided that weapon, thinking that other secondary weapons were decidedly better. As I discovered, I was wrong, and as I embraced this lesser-used weapon, at least in my playthrough, I discovered just how effective it could be, at least in this particular instance. With that solution in hand, I defeated the Grim Reaper and eventually made my way to the final fight with Dracula himself, who, by the way, has his own unique mechanics that need to be figured out. I know it might seem like I spent a lot of time equating Castlevania's enemy encounter design to a puzzle-like experience, but that's only because it's what makes the game more than just a traditional platforming title. If it weren't for the encounter design, Castlevania would simply be like any number of other action platform games, and it would have been reduced to its simplistic essence of run, jump, and attack, which honestly just isn't that exciting. The enemy encounter design and the mechanics for each enemy themselves is what keeps you on your toes, and what will likely keep bringing you back for more Castlevania goodness, even after you beat the game. That whole discussion, by the way, doesn't even really touch upon some of the other mechanics in the game, like the secondary weapon system, where you can pick up and use one of several different items, like a high-arcing axe, a forward-propelled knife, a boomerang-like cross, and a flame-inducing vial of holy water, and use those items in conjunction with your normal whip attacks, which can also be upgraded twice to extend the range of your primary weapon by finding whip extensions throughout each level. Those secondary weapons, by the way, add a good deal of variety to the overall experience, and I would wager a guess that everyone who plays the game likely has their favorite, or at least top two, items that they will immediately pick up if they see it within a given level. For me, the axe and the stopwatch are my go-tos, though there are definitely other items that are situationally useful, and in some cases absolutely essential to complete certain encounters. Those items do have limited use based on a resource pool, which in Castlevania is represented by hearts that you can pick up through each stage, so it's not like you can leverage these items without regard to anything else. But careful resource management and some skill will allow you to maintain the item you want to use at the moment you need to use it. As you're developing your skill, though, there will be occasions where you absolutely will die, and like I mentioned earlier, the penalty for death in Castlevania is surprisingly lenient. If you simply lose a life, you'll return to the beginning of the stage that you're currently on, and will lose whatever secondary weapon you may have had. If you end up losing all of your lives, you'll return to the beginning of the three-stage block that you're currently on, and will have to make your way back through whichever of those stages you may have already beaten. The fact that the game has infinite continues is a huge contributor to anyone's ability to actually beat the game, and the way I usually look at games like this is, if a game has infinite continues, I know it is something I can persevere through, and generally speaking, my overall frustration level is minimized, as I likely won't need to progress through too much content that I've already trivialized. Where games don't have unlimited continues, as was the case with many NES titles, I often feel greater frustration. I know that I can beat the game if I put enough effort into it, but failing later in a playthrough feels decidedly worse, because that means I have to play through a bunch of content repeatedly just to get to the part that might be causing me difficulty. Castlevania avoids that pitfall, which is good, because it is a pretty challenging game until you figure out its secrets and eccentricities. Anyway, I'll talk more about what I think of the title as we discuss the more specific elements of the game, but first, we need to take a look at the back of the box, because, as you all know, I love looking at the back of the box for these titles. I love learning how different companies marketed their titles, especially because around this time, we did not have the internet. We didn't have the ability to look up gameplay videos on YouTube. We didn't have the ability to get reviews from thousands of people. We had maybe a couple of magazines that we could refer to, but most of the time, our buying decision was based on what a box looked like as we were literally standing in a video game or computer game store. We picked up the box if the front art looked cool, we flipped it over, and if the back of the box made the game sound cool, we often bought it. So, for Castlevania, for the NES, the back of the box says, Castlevania, enter at your own risk. If you think it's scary on the outside, wait till you see the basement. You're in for the longest night of your life. Ghosts, goblins, demons, wolves, bats, creatures lurking around every corner. As you descend deeper and deeper, they get thicker and thicker. Better stick close to the cavern floor. It's your only chance of finding a weapon or two. You're going to need them. Because when you finally meet the Count, you know he'll be going for the jugular. So keep your courage up and your stake sharp. And say your prayers. And then, of course, there are some screenshots on the back of the box, as there always are, or at least usually are. And I've got to say, this box sold me. The back of the box made it sound like a fairly traditional monster horror-ish kind of experience, which I guess is par for the course. But, and I know I don't usually do this, if you look at the front of the box and you look at the artwork there, it looks downright awesome. There's Dracula's castle. There's Dracula himself off in the background with blood dripping off of his lips. There is your character with an awesome looking whip standing in front of that castle. And all you can think of at this point is, holy cow, what adventure am I about to experience? Of course, the back of the box makes the game sound pretty great too, and the screenshots look pretty good for an NES title. I mean, definitely 8-bit visuals, and retrospectively, I'll stop for now. We're talking about the graphics in just a second. But bottom line is the back of the box, and the box itself definitely sold me on this one. So, moving on to the more specific aspects of the game, we're going to start by talking about the graphics, which I was just about to do a second ago, but I will use this moment to say that Castlevania's graphics look pretty darn good for an 8-bit title, with a large variety of colors, a diverse set of enemies, and environment design that really does make it feel like you're traipsing through an ancient vampire's castle. Obviously, the game's visuals are not going to compare directly to modern action platform titles, but I would argue that the game looks as good, if not better, than many pixel art retro-inspired modern titles that have released over the last 5 to 10 years. I honestly have no complaint about the visuals. I think they perfectly fit the mood of the game and convey the exact information that needs to be conveyed. Moving on to the sound and music, the music in Castlevania is simply top-notch, with a soundtrack that contains several iconic songs that fans will likely recognize and perhaps hum to themselves even to this day. There is a significant amount of variety here, all of which expertly mixes 8-bit synthesized instruments that run the gamut from rock metal guitar riffs to trilling gothic harpsichord motifs, and I gotta tell you, I am here for all of it. Now, I recognize that there is a limit to 8-bit audio, especially music, as there aren't any sort of sampled instrument sounds being used here. All of the music is based on altering and shifting common waveforms to generate unique instruments, or at least 8-bit representations of unique instruments. But despite that limitation, the music here sounds really good, and my imagination ended up filling in the gaps as I listened to each track, almost creating my own orchestration of the music in my head. It's a testament to the quality of the music that I was able to listen to a song and say, oh, that must be a harpsichord. Because trust me, 8-bit chiptune audio does not typically mimic its intended instrument all that closely. But the way the composers recreated specific musical styles using those 8-bit instruments is what allows the music to transcend the pure mechanics of its creation to become something that can be appreciated musically outside of the game. That said, the music also works really well as background audio for the action happening inside of the game, and every single song meshes incredibly well with the environments you explore and the enemy encounters you'll be defeating throughout the game. Sound effects similarly are appropriate for the situations you'll be facing, with each effect mixing in perfectly with the action on the screen, so much so that you don't ever think about the sound effects as a separate thing. Psychologically, you simply believe that your actions and the sounds you hear are 100% linked, just like you would experience in quote-unquote real life. The bottom line is, the auditory environment in Castlevania is great, and I loved every single aspect of it. Moving on to the narrative and story, you take on the role of Simon Belmont, the latest in a long line of vampire hunters, and are tasked with vanquishing the most well-known vampire of them all, Count Dracula. The Belmont family has been locked in a centuries-old conflict with Dracula, and despite Simon's ancestors defeating Dracula in the past, the vampire simply won't stay dead. So it's up to you to enter Dracula's castle, defeat his menagerie of minions, and ultimately defeat the Count and banish him to hell once and for all. So I just got to say, the story here 100% worked for me. And while I know it is highly derivative of fairly popular vampire and monster literature and movies, it is woven perfectly into the lore of the game. There's really not much more to say here. If you enjoy the classic monster movies of the Golden Age of cinema, the various literary works of authors like Mary Shelley and Bram Stoker, or simply enjoy a good horror-themed adventure, Castlevania has got you covered. Now, I should mention that the story isn't really conveyed in-game at all, other than via the environments you're exploring and the enemies you're facing. But honestly, it doesn't really need any additional exposition. Most of these monster stories are so well known and are so significantly intertwined with popular culture that you immediately recognize your mission, whether you've read the story included in the game's manual and box art or not. Moving on to the playability and controls, we already talked a bit about the structure of the game, so I'm not going to repeat all of that here. But I do want to talk a bit about the game's controls, which are both simple, tight, and a bit more cumbersome than what I would personally consider ideal. To start, the control scheme of the game is pretty straightforward. You move around with your directional pad, you jump with your A button, and swing your whip with your B button. You also have at your disposal a series of secondary weapons, like I mentioned earlier, each of which can be used by pressing up and B at the same time. For the most part, these controls work perfectly fine, though from my perspective, the platforming elements are a bit heavier than what many modern gamers might be used to, and the act of jumping around the game world, where appropriate, feels a bit trickier than it likely needs to be. I did end up dying several times to platforming issues, and while I eventually got used to the overall feel of the title, it's definitely something that you need to become accustomed to, especially as you start encountering later stages where flying enemies can sometimes interrupt your jumps, sending you plummeting to your death. That being said, the platforming elements of the game aren't really the star of the show. The real focus of Castlevania is the combat, and here, the game controls really well, with each whip swing feeling impactful and matching your control inputs exactly as you would expect. Using secondary weapons similarly all work well, though I will admit that most secondary weapons, for me, ended up being used situationally rather than as a core component of my arsenal. This is likely just a stylistic preference, as I tend to be a hoarder in games, so rather than spend the heart resource currently associated with special weapons, I would oftentimes save those hearts in the off chance I might need them later. In almost every instance, later never really came, because I die some horrible death, so I do not recommend you play the game like I did. Definitely leverage the items you have at your disposal, as they can give you the edge you need to emerge victorious from some tricky encounters. Before we move on, though, I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention the way stairs are implemented in the game, as they've achieved an almost meme-like status amongst the broader retro gaming community. Many people contend that the stairs are one of the worst parts of Castlevania, and that they'd routinely fall from them when trying to climb up a flight of steps, or might get hit through a staircase when trying to fight an enemy. And sure, I would agree that the fact that stairs aren't truly solid unless you're already on them is a bit of an issue. But honestly, it didn't impact my playthrough one bit. Did I have a couple of cheap deaths because of the occasionally wonky stair behavior? Sure, everyone does, but it in no way detracted from my overall enjoyment of the title, and I feel like the issues surrounding the game's staircases have been blown a bit out of proportion. Otherwise, though, the game controls just fine, and after around 30 minutes playing the game, you should feel right at home with anything the game throws at you. That's not to say that the game becomes a cakewalk at that point, though, because the overall playability of the title remains an old-school action platformer kind of experience. And by that I mean, the game is challenging, though from my perspective, it is also fair, and like I mentioned earlier, Castlevania is actually surprisingly forgiving when compared to many of its NES 8-bit brethren. I don't think anyone would ever mistake it for a retro-inspired indie title, because there are next to no creature comforts here, and the controls and player movement are weightier than what I believe most modern gamers expect. But for the time it comes from, Castlevania does a ton of things right, and even today, remains an engaging, playable experience. So overall, how did it feel to play Castlevania? Well, for the most part, I really enjoyed my time playing the game. I found the exploration of the game's setting to be interesting, the monsters that you're forced to fight challenging, and the overall structure of the game to be engaging. It took me several hours to beat the entire game without using any sort of modern niceties like save states, and from my perspective, I got just the right amount of gameplay out of the title as I would have wanted. I will say that a good chunk of that time was spent on the final sections of the game, between the Grim Reaper set of stages and the final Dracula fight. So if I wanted to be picky, I could complain that there is a bit of a difficulty spike later in the game, and that there could have been somewhat of a smoother progression across the later levels of the game. But it really didn't bother me at all, and unlike some games where the difficulty spike feels like ramming headfirst into a wall while traveling at 100 miles per hour, Castlevania's difficulty spike feels more like an incorrectly graded speed bump, where you might damage the bottom of your car, and it's certainly a jarring experience, but ultimately, you yourself emerge unscathed from the incident. The bottom line, as long as you enjoy old-school action platformer game design, you will almost certainly enjoy Castlevania. It stands out as one of the better examples of this style of game, despite being an originator of some of the mechanics that would become popularized in later sequels. Those elements would be refined over time, but even in their original incarnation, there is a lot to like here. So overall, what is our verdict about Castlevania? Well, Castlevania, from my perspective, is a representative example of how games were designed back in the mid-80s, and luckily for all of us, that design was executed exceedingly well within the context of Castlevania's development. The experience is not 100% smooth, but it still remains an expertly crafted game, which is why, for me, Castlevania deserves its spot as the newest inductee into our pantheon of classic gaming. I would argue it's probably a bit less timeless than some other entries in our list, and it's probably more important and recognized for spawning the Castlevania franchise as opposed to being a standout game itself. But despite that, I do believe everyone should play the original at some point in their gaming careers. As long as you're in the mood for an old-school, somewhat unforgiving action experience, you should definitely check it out. And because of how much it does right, and how fun it remains to play, even today, Castlevania has just become the newest member in our pantheon of classic gaming. Was our episode on Castlevania. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT, I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have discussions. We do gaming challenges. We have a whole coins-based redemption system where you can get physical and digital prizes. If that sounds like fun to you, and honestly, it is fun to me, I highly encourage you to check us out over on Discord. I also highly encourage you to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/classicgamingtoday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon-exclusive bi-weekly podcast, Expansion Pack, where we talk about pretty much anything to do with classic games and even sometimes talk about modern stuff, patreon.com/classicgamingtoday is where it's at. Before we sign off for the week, I do want to mention that our next episode is going to be focused on super ghouls and ghosts. So feel free to write in if you have any particularly fond or not so fond memories of that experience. At the same time, I recognize you're likely listening to this podcast on any number of podcast engines. And if you would feel so inclined, it would be great if you could leave me a review. This is not about bolstering star counts. It's not about trying to harvest a ton of 5-star ratings, though if that happens, awesome, it means we're doing something right. No, what it's really all about is trying to deliver the best possible podcast I can. The only way to do that is to gather feedback from the listener community to make sure that I am hitting the mark and delivering the content that you want to listen to. We get new listeners every single day, which is simply amazing. I want to make sure that I can continue to deliver the best possible podcast I can, and I want to make sure that I'm taking all of that feedback into account to deliver something that hopefully is truly special. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode focused on super ghouls and ghosts. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone.